It is Thursday, September 13, 2012. I'm Administrative Law Judge Nicole Gaines. This is docket number 0720111L1761. This is being recorded in my office in Seattle, Washington. Appearing by telephone and representing the department is Ms. Deborah Tesh. Also appearing by telephone is the appellant, Ms. Elizabeth Campbell. We're here today for Ms. Campbell's motion requesting the issuance of subpoena due to taking and the setting of depositions for Lois Rasmussen, Sherry Waller, Margie Bogner, Susan Lewis, Jerry Gunville. So, Ms. Campbell, as you are aware at this stage and every stage of the proceedings, you have a right to be represented by an attorney. My knowledge is that your attorney previously withdrew and you are now representing yourself in this matter. Is that correct?
Correct.
For today's hearing, you have the right to present any evidence of any type, be it your own testimony, testimony of others, written documents, or anything to support your motion. You will, because it's your motion, you'll be given the opportunity to present evidence as to why I should grant the motion. Ms. Tesh will then be given the opportunity to respond to your motion. You'll be given another opportunity to respond to any, to reply to any of the information that Ms. Tesh provides. I do have some questions for all of you, but I'll wait to the end of your presentation. It's more likely than not to present them. What I have reviewed in preparation of this, as I read through our entire case file, as this case was previously assigned to Judge Kaler, so I read through the case file to get myself up to speed as to what has previously happened in the case. I did not look at any of the exhibits that were submitted other than unless they were attached to a motion. So I did want to put that on the record, and I don't remember if I put this on the record before or not, but prior to this case being transferred to me, Judge Kaler and I had discussed the matter colleague to colleague when she was determining whether or not she should grant the disqualification motion that she eventually did decide to sign. From that conversation, though, the only thing that I remember is us just discussing that in a previous employment situation, she had some type of dealings with the appellant and the vulnerable adult, I think. I don't remember any specifics, nor did she provide them about exactly what she had to find under that matter or anything along that lines, but I wanted to put that on the record so that if there's any problems or anyone feels that I should now disqualify myself, they can raise that now before we go forward with this motion and before we proceed any further with this case. So I'll let Ms. Tesh, do you have any issue with me remaining on this case, knowing what you know about the conversation that Judge Kaler and I had?
No, I do.
Okay, Ms. Campbell?
No, I don't.
Okay, all right. Okay, now, for today's motion, what I have reviewed, again, in addition to the case file about the previous occurrences that have happened, I have reviewed Ms. Campbell's motion for issuance of the subpoena due to Bruce Tigham, as well as the department's objection to the motion. So that's what I have read in preparation of today's case. So at this point in time, Ms. Campbell, I'll just put you under oath. Ms. Tesh, I know your attorney, but just for the sake of continuity, I'll go ahead and put you under oath as well. So if I'll have both of you raise your right hands, do you swear or affirm that the information you're about to provide today and the arguments you make are based on truth and fact, and you do so under penalty of perjury under the laws of Washington? Ms. Campbell?
Yes.
And Ms. Tesh?
Yes.
Okay. Alrighty, so Ms. Campbell, this is your motion. I'll give you the floor now to discuss why it is you think that I should grant these your motion.
Well, basically, I'm going to mainly rely on what I previously submitted to you. I don't really think that I have a lot to add to that today, unless there's something different that Ms. Tesh presents that wasn't in her objection. I think I've pretty well stated that I felt that the subpoenas should issue so that I can go through and explore with the people that are involved in this, what their involvement has been, the things that they participated in, the people that they talked to, the documents that they were working with. And so I kind of think that, like I said, I'll just rely on what it is at this point that I've submitted to you, because I don't think that I can embellish it or expand upon it to any particular point at this right now.
Okay.
So I'm going to pass on to Ms. Tesh.
Okay. All right, I do have a couple questions for you. Let's take these people that you're requesting one by one. So Mr. Rasmussen and, well, actually let's put these two together, and Margie Bollner. What I understand is that they investigated complaints that you had against the facility. Now, let me back up a little bit. In reviewing the file, I noticed that Judge Kaler, I did not find where Judge Kaler had ruled on the department's motion to compel your completion of a set of interrogatories that were propounded upon your attorney on your behalf. The last thing I saw in the file was a notation that your attorney stated that she didn't have time to complete those interrogatories, and that her argument was that this tribunal didn't have any authority to force the completion of those interrogatories. Was that motion ever ruled on? And I guess I'll pose this to Ms. Tesh, since from what I understand it was your motion. Was it ever ruled on, and has that, have those interrogatories ever been answered?
Yes, it actually was ruled upon. I'm not entirely sure what you're talking about, so let me just go through the procedure.
Well, wait, let me tell you exactly what I'm talking about. So, there was a memorandum of law submitted by you on March 20th, and it was requesting specific information from the appellant, and I didn't see an order from Judge Kayla addressing that.
That's because right before we were going to make arguments on my motion to compel, I did receive the information.
Okay, right, because what I did see was the other side of the coin, which was the order denying Ms. Campbell's motion to compel. Okay, so that was resolved through answering interrogatory.
Right, the parties resolved that. Right.
Okay.
Have the judge involved.
Okay, so that takes it. That was the one outstanding question I had. And then is the vulnerable adult in this case that is before me Chester Valley?
It is. Yes.
Okay, all right. That was my other question, because I never saw anything definitive that...
Well, it's supposed to be confidential, but I think we all know who we're talking
about. Okay, right. It makes it very difficult for me, in the sense of, I'm just kind of, because of how complex this matter is, I'm like, okay, I really need to know who we're talking about.
Okay,
so then last piece of information that I have, so now I'll go back to Ms. Campbell. So Ms. Campbell, help me understand, as far as your complaints against the facility, why do you feel that this is in any way connected to the finding that you financially exploited Mr. Valley?
Well, I think I put that in writing, what it is that I was, my reasoning behind that. But the thing is that this started over a boo-ha-ha over whether Chester should stay in that facility. The facility was trying to commit him to a psychiatric ward because he wandered, he would go to the elevator at the facility, and then there was multiple other things. There had been stealing, there had been stuff going on with his care, there had been, his glasses were broken, and, you know, there was even a possibility, too, that there had been some abuse by the facility, and so there had been just a long, ongoing problem with that facility, but the final thing came down to they wanted him out of there. And when I talked to, it was Ms. Rasmussen and this Margie, I was consulting with them through this time period when this APS complaint came up. but they were party to everything that was going on with the facility, and they were advising me that I did not have to agree to Chester's leaving. And if you look at the APS complaint, there was two parts to it. There was one part that I had financially possibly exploited Mr. Valley, and then the second part was that I hadn't, I don't know how they phrase it, but that I hadn't, you know, taken good care of him or something. Okay. I wasn't acting on his behalf in a proper manner. So if you look at Sherry Waller's documentation, she just goes through this kind of chain where she goes, okay,
I don't have, if I have Ms. Walker's documentation, I have not reviewed it because I tend not to review discovery because it's not my job until somebody presents it as an exhibit. So
what was in the reply that I sent to you is a copy of Ms. Waller's notes at the time that this occurred.
What reply are you referring to? Because I don't have a reply from you.
It's the reply to Ms. Tesh's objection.
Yeah, I didn't receive a reply. All I have is your original.
Well, it went to you via mail.
Yeah, let me just make sure. But yeah, I don't have a reply from you. That's why I said what I had reviewed prior to the starting taking testimony. I have your original motion, and then I have the department's objection. Those are the only two sets of documents that I received for this hearing today.
Well, there's a reply that went to, and I presume Ms. Tesh has it because she got it several ways.
Okay, I don't.
So I mean, that being said, then I guess I cannot rely upon the things that I wrote to you. But I guess kind of to back up, then if you don't have the reply, then I would have to put through, you know, all the things that I said in the reply.
Well, hang on a minute.
But the thing is that, you know, how this all relates to this finding, it's like, well, Ms. Tesh likes to act like this was a preponderance of the evidence, but that was not true. It was
What are you talking about? Hold on. What are you referring to when you say a preponderance of the evidence?
Well, she said in her objection that there had been kind of this objective review and that their finding was based on a preponderance of the evidence standard, and I objected to that, and I said that was not true, that the record shows that it had nothing to do with a preponderance of evidence. It had to do whether I met DSHS's time frame for paying Chet's bill. And that's when they decided to substantiate. They didn't substantiate because they sat there and went, oh, she's a, you know, exploited this man. They substantiated because they went back and had told my attorney, well, if she pays it in time before we get to the end of the investigation, then we're not going to substantiate. And since I wasn't able to pay it at that time, then they substantiated. I paid it after that a couple months later, but then by then they'd already said DSHS and said, well, we're going to substantiate it. But DSHS's case record sets it out by Carol Hamill and Jerry Gunville that if I paid the bill, they weren't going to substantiate their case.
So I'm going to object to this one because she's discussing the merits of the case. And it really
No. I think it's, I'm going to allow it because it's, that was one of the issues that I have. Whether or not the information she's seeking is relevant has to do with what defense she's asserting, and what I
right,
hear
but
her.
Right, that doesn't have anything to do with Lois Rasmussen. That's she's talking about the investigation itself right now, and Lois Rasmussen and Margie Brower had absolutely no input in the APS investigation. In fact, they were never contacted by Mr. Gunville, and he never reviewed any of the RCS complaints in order to make his substantiation.
Okay, and so I'll take that under advisement as I'm listening to her explanation of why she feels it relevant. Before we do that, Ms. Tesh, did you find a copy of the reply?
Yes, I did.
Can you fax that to me? Can we take a break and you fax that to me so I can review it?
Sure.
Okay. Do you have our fax number here?
I do.
Okay. Ms. Campbell, it's very important that I have the opportunity to review everything clearly before we go into argument. So could we take a 15-minute recess for Ms. Hesh to fax that information over to me and for me to review it, and then we'll come back on the record and we'll take further argument?
Sure.
Okay, Ms. Campbell. So we're going to go off the record right now. Ms. Hesh, if you'll fax that over to me, I'll review it, and I'll get all of you back on the line as soon as I finish reviewing it. Okay, thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
We're back on the record. I have Ms. Hesh and Ms. Campbell. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. I have now received and reviewed Ms. Campbell's reply in response to the department's objection. Ms. Campbell, now you had indicated that there were some attachments to this. I did not receive any attachments. I just received your written reply, which is 9 pages. Were there some attachments that you had to it?
There's, I think the order that I put the document in, that the exhibit is after the certification of service.
Okay.
I did not get an exhibit if there is one attached. I received the reply and then the declaration.
The declaration of service? Okay. So neither Ms. Hesh nor I have any other document other than your written...
I'm sorry, in her mailed one, there is an exhibit. I'm sorry, I didn't get it with the emailed version.
Okay. So for purposes of not having this stop again, Ms. Hesh, could you read that exhibit and that attachment into the record at this point in time?
Attached as Exhibit A is Leon Sullivan Healthcare Center Resident Progress Note from October 12th of 2010.
Okay.
It's quite extensive. It's 200 pages.
Okay. Well, then let's break one more time, and or I tell you what, Ms. Campbell, could you just summarize what it is that's in there for me?
Well, basically what Sherry Waller does, she's the social worker and the reporter, she went through this scenario. She said basically that Chester wasn't safe at the facility and that I wasn't cooperating with his being moved, and that she kind of segued into this thing about, well, there's an outstanding bill. She referenced that and then said, well, I'm making a report to APS, or made a report, that I'm not acting in his best interest, and also that a possible exploitation. And then she signs off that she had made the report, and I think it's October 12th, 2012, that she did that.
Okay. So before we go any further, let me just make sure that I'm understanding where each of you is coming from. According to the amended finding letter that I have that's dated April 23rd, 2012, the department is alleging that Ms. Campbell financially exploited the vulnerable adult by failing to pay his $9,022.20 bill for medical care that he received in a facility between February 10th of 2010 and November of 2010. And that she also, between July 2009 and March 2010, while acting in a fiduciary capacity, used the vulnerable adult's funds for her own personal expenses. So from what I understand, Ms. Hesh, the department is making two allegations of financial exploitation. Are those the only two allegations that the department is making?
Correct. There was a neglect report, and that was found unsubstantiated.
Okay.
So the final findings were purely financial exploitation.
Okay. Now, as for the bill, the approximately $9,000 bill, Ms. Campbell, if I understand what you were arguing, your argument is that initially you were not paying the bill because you were disputing it because you felt that the vulnerable adult was not receiving adequate care. Am I understanding that correctly?
Correct.
And then when it became clear to you that the department was going to use the unpaid bill as a means of finding that you had financially exploited him, you went ahead and paid it, despite your disagreement with the bill. Is that correct?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so the bill has now been paid. Is that correct, Ms. Tesh?
As far as my understanding.
Okay. So then, as for the other argument, which is the use of the funds for personal reasons from July of 2009 through March of 2010, Ms. Campbell, as I understand it, none of the people that you have asked to take the deposition of in any way have any information regarding that allegation. Is that correct?
No, they don't.
Okay.
Well,
so
actually, I should reverse that. That Margie and the Lois Rasmussen, they actually were, I did consult them about what was going on at that facility, but Jerry Gunville and I'm not sure about Sue Lewis. Sue Lewis is kind of a, well, she's not directly, as far as I know, involved in the investigation, but Jerry Gunville definitely would know about the other parts that they're doing.
Okay. And Ms. Tesh, as I understand it, the department is intending to call Mr. Gunville as one of their witnesses. Is that correct?
That is correct, and we're not objecting to the appellant deposing Mr. Gunville so long as she amends her subpoena to conform with the requirements. It's mainly Rasmussen, Brower, and Waller that we're objecting to a deposition entirely.
Okay. So,
also, Sherry Waller, I mean, I know they have the right to object to it, but Sherry Waller is not an employee of the SHS, and neither is Margie.
Right.
So, they have their own right to object, as far as I know.
Okay, right, but the department has a right to object to any witness
sure.
if they feel that the person doesn't have any relevant information. Okay. All right, so let's talk about Ms. Rasmussen and Ms. Bolnar. Ms. Campbell, if I understand your request for them, it's because you feel that they have knowledge that you had made complaints about the care that the vulnerable adult was receiving at the facility, and your intention is to call them as witnesses to provide testimony that you had complaints about the vulnerable adult's care.
Correct.
Okay. And that goes to your defense of you didn't pay the bill because you were disputing the bill because of the care that he was getting.
Correct.
Okay. Sherry Wallner, employee of the facility, how is anything that she would provide different than what Ms. Bolnar or Mr. Rasmussen would provide?
Because she's acting as an agent of the facility itself, and, the thing is that she wasn't necessarily party to the same things that Lois and Margie were party to, and plus, she's party to the thing that the facility was doing, is it wasn't about, anything about Chester's care. This was about getting him out of the facility, and prior to the time that they...
Okay, I'm confused. I'm confused because my understanding is you were disputing paying the bill because you didn't believe that he was getting the level of care that he needed. Is my understanding incorrect?
No, that's correct. But, none of these things just is in itself a single item stand alone. You have to look at the whole context of what was going on. That one, there was the dispute about Chester's care, and then... how was the facility going to get Chester out of there? Well, they hit upon this idea about complaining about the bill, and that is the ultimate vehicle that did get him out of there. And that's why in Ms. Waller's notes that she's got there, she clearly goes through that whole scenario. She starts out with the complaints and then segues on through to, oh, I can do the APS, you know, make the complaint about the financial exploitation, and then I can issue the, it's some form that they do to get checked to leave the facility. But there's a almost a two-month history prior to that with Sherry where she's going through this situation with me about trying to get Chester out of the facility. So it didn't just happen, each one of these things stand alone. It was all, you know, kind of a whole series of events.
But how is that relevant to whether or not you did or did not financially exploit him?
Well, the presumption is that the department just, you know, and I put that in my reply. I mean, if you look at it and pull,
I know you put in your reply, but I'm asking you to explain it on the record.
Well, the thing is that we have this presumption under that scenario that everything that DSHS does is altruistic and all they're about is protecting patients, and so therefore any finding that they do is, you know, kind of beyond reproach, and that's not the case. The thing is,
but that's not what I have to look at. I mean, the issue. Hold on a minute. Hold on. Let me explain to you how I see what the rule. What it's very clear what this case is about as far as the burdens of proof and what has to be shown. It is whether or not you financially exploited the vulnerable adult. So, in this case, the department is alleging that you failed to pay his bill. Your defense that you're alleging is that it wasn't that you failed to pay the bill because you were using the funds for other purposes, but that you had a legitimate concern for his care and therefore you weren't paying the bill because it's really a financial, it's a financial dispute as to he wasn't getting the care, so therefore your response was, I'm not paying you for services that you're not providing, if I understand what you're arguing. So to that extent, while I understand what you're saying, that there may have been some scheme to get him out of the facility, that's not what's at issue here. And I understand, I hear what you're saying.
Excuse me, Nicole. If you're
hold on a minute. Whoa. You don't get to call me Nicole. I'm a judge.
All right, well, excuse me, Judgment Gaines, if you're just going to talk over to me and not listen to anything I have to say, it's like, well, you're getting to present the case that you want it to be.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm not trying to talk over you. I'm trying to understand where you're trying to go with your defense, because I have to rule what's relevant or not here. So I'm trying to say, okay, this is what I understand if your defense is this, this is what I understand you're trying to present. Now, what I don't understand and what I'm asking you to explain is how what the department's motive, whatever their motivation may have been or how it got to be there, how is that relevant to whether or not you did or didn't pay a bill? That's what I'm trying to hope.
But that's like what Ms. Tesh wants to do, is act like, well, the department gets to find what it finds, and we only get to talk about what it found, but I don't get to act, you know, have any defense to any of that. I get to go, okay, the bill wasn't paid, so yeah, you're right, I financially exploited him. We don't get to find out how that came about. We don't get to find out what my relationship to Chester was. We don't get to find out what my fiduciary or my financial relationships to him are. We don't get to find out what anybody's motivation is, only that, oh, a bill wasn't paid. And one of my defenses has been, and it isn't that I just have one defense, oh, I didn't agree with the bill and I didn't pay it. Because as I said in my reply, this is a complex thing.
Mm-hmm.
These things don't just happen stand alone. One of my defenses is that the department, DSHS, is merely acting as a collection agent. I mean, if they really were interested in vulnerable adults, then what in the world were they going, well, pay the bill and we won't find against you? So, I mean, there's other aspects to this, too. So, I mean, I don't appreciate that it's just all the department this, the department that, and that's not what the Office of Administrative Hearing claims that all this is about. It says that there is flexibility in how appellants get to present their case.
It has to be relevant. It has to be relevant, and that's why
it is relevant. It is relevant what went on, and we get to test what it is that the department does. The department is not beyond questioning about what their motivations are. If they have a motivation to go out and collect bills on behalf of nursing homes, then, well, we should get to talk about that. They don't want to talk about that because, yeah, that makes their case harder. It's easy to do a case of go, well, the bill wasn't paid, so that must be financial exploitation. And I think that amply showed that there's more at stake than just going, oh, you know, some simple deal, I financially exploited Chet. There's more at stake here than this. I'm going to get put on some damn registry if I lose on this. And how would you like to be on the registry with sex offenders and people that have taken, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, you know, and gone out and bought Cadillacs and stuff? And but I don't get to tell my story because, you know, the rush is to get me on that registry.
That's not my rush. That's not
my
rush.
Well, it's not your rush, but it's the department's rush. I recognize it's not your rush.
Anyway, now, okay. So, again, going back to my original question, I still am not, I understand your defense is, like I said, that this is really a dispute about payment of a bill and not financial exploitation in the terms of what the statute was created for. Now,
but it's not just hinging on the idea that that bill wasn't paid. It's also hinged on this other idea, too. About, well, what's the department's motivation? Well, their motivation was to get the bill paid.
Okay.
And they accomplished that, but in the meantime, you know, they trashed me in the process.
Okay. So I will read Ms. Waller's note. I'll have Ms. Tesh fax that over, that the note that was attached to your reply, and I'll take that into consideration when I make my decision. Okay, now, what I'm saying is, I was trying to get you to orally explain to me what it was that you, why you felt her testimony was relevant. That's why I was asking you questions, but it's clear that I'm not going to get that answer directly, so let's move on.
Well, Susan, to you that some people can speak better orally and some people can write better, and I would say in this case that my better presentation is in what it is that I've written, because then I have the opportunity to sit down and go through the whole process of what it is that I'm thinking. And so I don't want you to, you know, unfairly judge me because, oh, I didn't put it well in oral form. I mean, I think that I've set it out very well what it is that I was getting at in my written reply.
Well, and with all due respect, that's why I was asking you questions, because I felt that your written reply was more of an emotional statement, which is fine, emotional statement, and it didn't give me legally what I was looking for to answer the legal questions that I have. So let's move on at this point. Okay, Susan Lewis, she is a DSHS employee. You're asking to depose her. Why is it that you feel that Ms. Lewis has information that is relevant to your defense?
Your Honor, the department isn't actually objecting to her deposing Sue Lewis because we are intending to call her as a witness.
Okay.
With the right to depose her, and we're not contesting that. I'm contesting, as far as Jerry Gunn, Lewis go, just to the form of the...
Okay. So the only three people that the department is objecting to the deposition of is Lois Rasmussen, Sherry Waller, and Margie Wagner. I'm not quite sure either. Okay. Now, Ms. Campbell, I do want you to understand that administrative hearings are different than Superior Court. Even if these subpoenas for deposition are issued, there isn't necessarily anything that forces, nor do I have the power to force these people to comply with them. You do realize that, right?
Okay.
All right. So now let's move on to your request for documents. It's my understanding that several public disclosure requests have been made. And in reviewing your subpoenas, my concern is that they are very overbroad and do not in any way indicate what documents you are requesting the people that you've requested to appear to bring. So let's talk about this. I need specifics. What documents is it, what are the documents that you are specifically asking them to bring, and how are they in any way relevant to this case?
Well, I think that, you know, that's always the challenge, whether you're doing discovery or public disclosure requests or something like this. It's like, well, if you don't know what they have, how can you sit there and say, well, I would like this document. I'd like, you know, the letter that you wrote on X date to so-and-so. So, I mean, we have a general idea of what it is, the documentation that DSHS goes through. But, I mean, even the public disclosure request, well, that hasn't been returned, so I don't even know what they have. So the only thing I can do is confine it and say, well, that it only can be related to this case. But other than that, I mean, I have no idea what documents DSHS holds. They've sent a case record that's dated, I think, that the latest time is something like maybe February or January of this year, and yet since then, they've gone on and done another investigation and haven't provided an updated, you know, version of their case report. So, you know, who knows what they have? I don't know. I can't tell you.
The department has provided all discovery from the investigative file and anything that they intend to use at hearing. She has a copy of everything. Those findings.
You did a subsequent investigation, and you didn't supply anything for that.
I supplied a supplemental discovery packet to your attorney prior to her withdrawal. That is the entirety of our case file.
And that was before you updated your letter?
No, that was at the time we updated our letter.
Well, you know what? Considering you've had communications with Amar Youngs, there's no notation that there was any communication with her in the stuff that you provided. So there must be something else.
Oral communication. I have documentation. We contacted her to see if the bill remained unpaid, and it was. That was
There's no notation about that.
There's the document showing it's unpaid. What more do you need?
You know what? Really, that's kind of a circular commentary.
Okay, ladies. Let's. Ms. Campbell, Ms. Tesh, do you know the status of the information requested in the public disclosure request?
I do not. I don't do public disclosure. That's handled at headquarters.
Have you in any way made inquiries about where they are with getting this? Because since you're relying on the fact that she made these public disclosure requests, it seems it'd be prudent for you to check to see the status of them, since you're asking me to deny it because there was this public disclosure request made.
Well, my point is that those parties are absolutely irrelevant to the issue for this hearing. She did make public disclosure requests, but whether she got the information or not, even if she did receive it, it's still irrelevant. And my point is that she shouldn't be allowed to subpoena these individuals to provide information that would be inadmissible as discovery.
How is it inadmissible if it goes directly to one of her defenses, which was this is really not financial exploitation but a dispute over a bill, and that she legitimately...
I don't believe, and I think that that will come out in our hearing, and I don't think that Ms. Rasmussen or Ms. Brower have any information whatsoever regarding that issue. They have information regarding the quality of care and the complaints and the 30-day notice to vacate, etc., but the whole financial piece is not something that they were involved in. We have all the documentation that shows that she used Mr. Valley's funds for her own personal expenses. We have an unpaid bill. We have the 30-day notice to vacate stating that they are asking him to leave due to the unpaid bill. Now, she did make sporadic payments, so if she was having an issue with the quality of care and wasn't paying because of that, why did she continue to make a payment every 3 months? And I think that this will all come out in the hearing, and this is all relevant to the financial exploitation, but I don't see how Ms. Rasmussen and Ms. Brower have anything to offer.
Well, except that they do, because I did talk to them and find out what my rights were, even with Chet's unpaid bill.
But all those things that you've been talking about as your defenses go toward the motivation for a referral to APS.
But then they know that what, you know, they can also verify what it is that I'm saying. I mean, if nothing else, they act then as verification of what my actions are that I'm saying that I took.
Well, the department's stance is that whether that was a valid reason or not, for them to make a referral is irrelevant. What we have is an unpaid bill and you spending money on yourself.
That's a cheap shot and that's a cheap throwaway. Ladies.
Okay. Ms. Campbell, I've given you quite a bit of time to explain to me your position. Ms. Tesh, I want to give you this opportunity to explain uninterrupted Ms. Campbell why it is that I should deny Ms. Campbell's request. You were starting to go into that, but I want to give you the opportunity to complete your argument.
The WAC 3880203QO states that the ALJ should deny a request to issue a subpoena if the witness has no actual knowledge of the facts or requested documents are not relevant. In this case, Lois Rasmussen, Marty Brower, and Sherry Waller have no actual knowledge of the facts that the APS investigator reviewed and relied upon to determine that financial exploitation took place, and that is the issue for hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Sherry Waller did, as an employee of Leon Sullivan, provide the investigator with a copy of unpaid invoices, the 30-day notice to vacate, and an admission record, but that does not mean that she has knowledge of the finances that occurred between Chester Valley and Elizabeth Campbell, and that's what the heart of this case is. The department has supplied the appellant with copies of all the documents that Leon Sullivan has sent us, and we've sent them all our discovery. I don't know what she's fishing for or thinks that she's going to find, but there is no additional information to send. There's no need to depose Ms. Waller for further information just because she was the one who sent us those documents. Given the fact that this case is purely about the investigations and findings of financial exploitation, the investigator never spoke to or reviewed the cases, never spoke to Ms. Rasmussen or Brower, and never reviewed the cases from RCS. And there's simply no basis for requiring a deposition of these individuals. What she's talking about is there was disputes between the facility and herself regarding his care, and therefore she feels that she was retaliated against by making this finding, or sorry, this report of financial exploitation. But that is what EPS does. They take an allegation and they determine whether it's valid or not. And we did determine, based on our own investigation and the actual financial documents that we received, that there was financial exploitation. It has nothing to do with the quality of his care or any dispute that was behind this referral. We had a preponderance of evidence to prove that she had financially exploited Mr. Valley. The quality of care the AB received at Leon Sullivan is not the issue of this case. This is the only thing the individuals that she requested to pose would be able to comment upon. The appellant seeks to expand this issue for hearing to include her complaints regarding his care. However, these complaints have been addressed by RCS, and that was the proper forum. And there was, to my understanding, there was no finding that Leon Sullivan had any improper care. I have not reviewed any of those complaints, but my understanding was that nothing came of it. Because none of the testimony or documents that these witnesses are capable of producing is anticipated to lead to relevant admissible discovery, the subpoenas should be denied. I'd also like to point out that DSHS does not act as a bill collecting agency. We determine whether financial exploitation has taken place. Whether or not this person actually ended up paying the bill is not the affair of DSHS. Even if we substantiate, that has no legal, addition to her or to Leon Sullivan being able to get a judgment. I mean, so if we substantiate, that still doesn't get Leon Sullivan any farther in getting their bill paid. And I have spoken to Mr. Gunville, and I've spoken to everybody who was involved at APS in investigating this case, and everyone states that nobody ever told her that we would not substantiate if she paid the bill. And I have no evidence that she paid the bill. She may have, but we didn't. That's not part of our investigation, because whether the bill is paid or not, we still substantiate.
Mm-hmm.
And that is in our policy manual. There's no negotiating.
So the department's point of view is that at the time that the department made its substantiated finding, there that she was failing to act in the vulnerable adult's capacity, in her capacity as a vulnerable adult's durable power attorney, because she had failed to use his funds to pay for his care.
Our allegation is that she used funds for herself.
Well, I was getting to that point, that she had failed to pay for his care while continuing to use the funds to pay for her own personal needs.
That is correct. She made some payments to the facility, approximately every 3 months or so she made a payment of his participation, but there were months in between that where the no payments were made, resulting in the approximately $10,000 bill. And prior to that, when he was in an adult family home, which is not even Leon Sullivan, which she's saying is the motivation for the full financial exploitation, there was another facility where she continued to do the same thing. There is an unpaid bill to that facility while she continued to use money from Mr. Valley's.
But that's not part of this APS finding?
Yes, it is. It's the part that's on the second amend, when we amended the allegation to include a prior period.
Hold on a minute. So this period from February...
It's that paragraph underneath, the bigger paragraph, and it's a period that goes just prior to the original loan.
Okay. So from July 2009 through March of 2010, the allegation is that she used the income and resources for her own personal use?
Yes, and she also failed to pay that facility as well.
Okay, that's not part of the allegation, though. The allegation.
I will amend the letter then.
The way I'm reading this is that she was using the funds for her own use. Now, if you're trying to ask me at the hearing to make a finding that part of that financial exploitation is that she failed to use the funds for his care, then you need to amend your...
I will. I will have that done this week.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry I interrupted you, Ms. Tesh.
Almost finished. I was just going to then discuss the form of the subpoenas if you...
Yes, I do want to, and that is definitely, yes, please present that argument.
Now, if you're going to issue them to all parties, I think that it's important because Ms. Rasmussen and Ms. Margie Brower and Sherry Waller are not represented by an attorney, that they don't have anyone to consult with regarding the subpoena, that they are defective as to form because they fail to provide the proper notice to the department, which is that information that's required by law to be included in regarding their rights. And so that needs to be amended. But they also fail to supply clear direction regarding what documents that they are to bring. I mean, it's just this vague, amorphous, bring everything you have. And I also would like to point out that the period that she's requested goes far prior to our substantiation period and then goes up far past. So I don't see how those periods are relevant on either end, and I think that the subpoenas should be amended to narrow that date.
Right, because they start in January and the allegation is July.
And then they go through
October of this year, which doesn't even exist yet. Again, there's no allegation about anything that happened. Okay.
Hold on, wait,
Ms. Tesh. You'll get your opportunity, Ms. Campbell, but this is Ms. Tesh's opportunity. Okay. Ms. Tesh, anything else?
I'm actually finished.
Okay. All right. Okay, now, Ms. Campbell, I'll give you an opportunity to respond to Ms. Tesh's information argument.
Well, I'd like to just point out, and I said this in my reply, she claims that it's not about collecting the bill, and it's like on page 8 of Gunville's report, that's part of her exhibits. It specifically says, he states that discussed case with APS supervisor Carol Hamill. I was advised that if the bill has not been paid, then I would substantiate for financial exploitation. He goes on and says that again 2 days later. So it was never about, you know, oh, the bill wasn't paid and we're doing financial exploitation. It was about getting that bill paid. And the bill was paid, despite what it's, you know, the inference that maybe it wasn't.
But anyway, in regards to that dating on the subpoenas are not going to be going out anyway. They're not going to have to comply with them until in November. So that's the reason that October date is on there, because they would still have things that could possibly be occurring or things that they're participating in that would cover that time period. And like I said, as far as the January date, well, these things don't just happen, you know, all of a sudden down in one date. There's a whole series of things that comes beforehand. And Carol, or that Margie and the Lois, that's conversations that were going on and things with them that were occurring back in January. So that's why I covered those dates the way that I did.
Okay. Anything else, Ms. Campbell?
No.
Okay. Anything else, Ms. Tesh?
Yeah, I'd just like to respond to the note that Jerry Gunville put in there. She's reading it in the way that she intends to read it. Mr. Gunville will be available to provide testimony at the hearing and also at the deposition to explain what he meant by writing it that way.
Okay. All right. Okay. Anything else, Ms. Campbell?
No.
Ms. Campbell, I do have a question. Why is it that you feel that you need to take these parties' deposition, and you do realize that the cost is a cost that you yourself will have to incur?
I recognize that.
Okay. Is there a reason why you feel the need to take a deposition as opposed to...
You know, what need would you feel if you're going to be put on a registry with sex offenders?
This is not about me, Ms. Campbell. This is about you.
Well, it is about me. Why wouldn't I want a full defense of what it is that I've done?
Ms. Campbell.
Why wouldn't I want to be able to present my case about how these things transpired? You know, Deborah Tesh, it's easy for her to go, oh, you know, we got some financial documents, but you know what? They're not providing the rest of the story.
Ms.
This
Campbell.
This is all stuff that we get to provide on my behalf.
Ms. Campbell, have you in any way had any... discussions with any of these people that you are requesting a deposition of?
No.
Okay. All right.
Not about the subpoenas. I've talked to them, obviously, in the course of my whole relationship to this situation, but no, I haven't talked to them about any subpoenas.
Okay.
And I haven't talked to them, like Sherry Waller, I have not talked to her since Chester left the facility. I never talked to her about her APS referral, and neither have I talked to Lois or Margie about the APS stuff. There's nothing that I discussed with them about any of that.
And what is your response to Ms. Tesh's objection to your subpoenas as being overly broad and not specific?
Well, every governmental department in the state has the opportunity to maintain an index of the documents.
I'm talking about the legal requirement.
Well, I know, and I'm saying the department doesn't have an index of documents, so I can't particularly sit down and go, well, this is the one that I want. I mean, there's just no record of what it is that they do hold. So I have to say, well, it has to be related to this case. That's the best I can do.
I understand that, but there are legal requirements as to what you need to meet to have a subpoena issued. Do you have a response as to why, to the allegation that your subpoenas don't meet the legal requirement?
Well, I don't know that they don't. If it's reviewed in Superior Court, maybe that question would be answered. But the thing is that I can't possibly know what it is that they have, and I don't have their public disclosure requests stuff. You know, I don't have the responses from that, so how is it I'm supposed to say with specificity, please give me this, this, and this? All I can go to is subject matter. And you know what? If I knew what they had, maybe I could ask with specificity.
All right. Anything else, Ms. Campbell?
Nope.
Anything else, Ms. Tesh?
No.
Okay. All right, Ms. Tesh, if you would please fax over the attachment to the reply provided by Ms. Campbell, I would appreciate that.
Okay.
That will conclude this hearing for today. I will give you a written decision regarding whether or not I'm going to grant the request for the subpoenas within the next 2 weeks. You'll have a written decision from me. Okay, discovery doesn't close until January. All right. If there's nothing else, that'll conclude this matter for today.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Judge Gaines, for your patience and perseverance. I'm sure it's difficult, but I appreciate just the same your job that you're doing and everything.
You're welcome. Ms. Tesh, the one thing I do request of you, though, is there is a public disclosure request that has been propounded upon the department by Ms. Campbell. I would like you to please talk to whatever entity that is within the department and find out the status of it and then provide a written status report to you.
That is part of the law, and that entity has been communicating directly with Ms. Campbell stating when she can anticipate supplying those items.
That's what I want to make sure that has occurred.
Yeah, that's part of the question, so they have been sending her the proper notice.
Right, and that's what I was concerned about when I kept hearing, well, I don't know, and I'm like, well, the laws on public disclosures, you have to tell.
Okay.
So, Ms. Campbell, I'm concerned because you're stating you don't know when you're going to get this information. Part of the public disclosure law is that they have to tell you an anticipated date for providing those. Have you not received that letter from them? You should have one.
I've received letters, but the thing is, as you're looking at the actual disclosure, Ms. Tesh claimed that the things that I was asking were things that they already produced, which I said in my reply. If that was the case, then I would have probably received those things by now, but and if you do any public disclosure work, this is something that's an ongoing process. The agencies regularly say, oh, we'll do it by X date, but then they also can come along and go, well, that date didn't work, and here's our new date. So, yeah, there's some status reports that they give you and that they say, well, here's the date, but until you receive the documents, it's kind of like, well, in this case, not really productive. I mean,
and have you received status updates as to anticipated dates in this case?
I think I got one about 3 weeks ago or something.
Okay, and do you recall what they said the anticipated date at this point is?
I think it was in late September.
Okay, all right. All right, well, if there's nothing else, that'll conclude this hearing for today. Thank you, ladies.
All right, thank you, Judge.
Bye-bye.